Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In a lot of restaurants around the world, the staff is called the family. You work behind that kitchen door and you have a new family, whether you want it or not. In restaurants, you have just a few hours each night to nail it or to fail, and that pressure cooker stress draws in the disenfranchised and the driven, because behind those swinging doors lies acceptance.
It is a family. Once you're in, you're in. And if someone got a DUI, I would get up in the middle of the night and get anybody out of jail that works for me. You know, if anyone has issues with their family, or I'll buy them a plane ticket and send them. You know, I want to take care of them as if we are a family.
That's Chef John Gorham of Portland's Toro Bravo. He had a pretty rough childhood, but in the restaurant family, he found a way to turn it around. Stay with us for more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Take two people curious about food, a restaurant chef and a writer and designer who can wield a camera, and a culinary agenda that takes them around the world. This is the perennialplate.com. Its creator is Daniel Klein. The videographer is Mira Fine. Hey, you two, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
You were recently in Mexico, so what did you discover?
We went to Chiapas, which is the southernmost state of Mexico, to a town called Tapachula. It's about 20 minutes from the Guatemala border, and most people only go there for a stopover before going to Guatemala.
Uh-huh.
And so people were surprised because they said, oh, you're going to Guatemala tomorrow? And we said, no, we're actually here to meet a woman who grows cacao.
Cocoa beans.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we never really know what to expect when we're meeting someone for the first time. And I remember being surprised when we opened the car door and saw this beautiful Mexican woman who was in her 70s. She had her hair all gray in one braid that went down past her waist, and this beautiful blue and green colored skirt down to her ankles, carrying this humongous machete. And took us into the jungle, which was where she'd been farming cacao for 50 years.
Tell me about her and tell me about what she did.
Well, the amazing thing is that, you know, we're walking around this jungle and there's all these trees. I didn't really realize what a cacao pod looked like. And all these pods are hanging off these trees. They kind of look like a super pregnant banana with a hard shell.
Uh-huh.
They're bright orange when they're ripe. They're green when they're not ripe. And they're brown when they're completely overripe. And so we're walking around, and with her machete, she would hit it on one of the pods and it would fall off and she could break it open, which is when we could see the actual cacao beans covered in like a fleshy pulp, which was the fruit, which was amazing.
I've heard it tastes fabulous. What does it taste like?
It tastes, well, it's like this fleshy, slippery.
I think it tastes kind of like.
Sounds like a lychee nut or
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe a cross between a lychee and passion fruit.
Does anybody sell it?
They should, is what I'm thinking.
It's sort of astounding that cacao pods are only used for the chocolate, because it's like the most incredible thing you've ever had.
Yeah.
Which I think, even though it's not tasted directly, that sweetness and that deliciousness must enter into the chocolate. And that's part of the reason why you get, with really good chocolate, fruity flavors, because
there is that.
And the woman who took us around the farm, she actually said it's not just that fruit that contributes to the fruity flavor of the chocolate, but also the trees that surround it. So it's very important that you don't grow cacao in an open field. You need it to be surrounded by banana trees and orange trees and passion fruit and all these different wonderful things that she says contribute to the chocolate. And she actually thinks they're so important that she talks to her trees and shares with them how she's protecting them and loves them. It's very beautiful.
It is. Does she actually make the chocolate?
She does. That fruit around each cacao nib or nut, you let it ferment all together with the fruit in it for 4 days. And then you take it out and dry it, toast it, and then peel it.
So this woman makes her own chocolate, but she also sells her cacao to a cooperative.
Uh-huh.
And we went to that cooperative, and we saw how they traditionally toast the beans.
How do they do that?
They take it in a clay pot that's about 4 inches deep and quite like a couple feet wide, and start a fire.
Right.
And you move the beans constantly. You can't let them sit because you need even toasting throughout.
Yes, yeah.
And so moving quickly, very smoky. And then they start to pop like popcorn. You get this popping sound. And so that happens more and more when it begins to stop, then the cacao is finished. By then you'll smell a little bit of what smells maybe like chocolate.
Uh-huh.
It starts to smell delicious. You take it off, and then they're ready to crack open. And inside the bean are the nibs, and the nibs are the beautiful thing that you want to eat and that makes chocolate.
Ah.
So we sat around with this woman on her table in her backyard in the shade and spent a couple hours cracking open these cacao beans and chatting. And they don't really do that very often in that way.
Right.
There's machines that do it. But
right.
You could see the sort of community that develops from sitting around. And then, of course, you get to eat them. And we particularly ate the blonde nibs. Like 1 in 20 or 1 in 100 of the cacao beans has a blonde chocolate in it.
Oh, my.
And that's a sweeter, milder flavor, a little more fruity than the regular cocoa nibs.
What does a chocolate nib taste like? Is it bitter? Is it?
It's very crunchy. It has that dark chocolate taste to it where there's no sweetness, but sometimes there's a little bit of, you know, banana or a little bit of fruitiness to it on the back end.
Did you get a chance to taste the sort of final product, finished chocolate?
We did. We got a chance to taste a couple chocolates. We tasted the chocolate that they make down in Chiapas, which is a more granular drinking chocolate that
right.
you put with milk or water and you drink warm. And it sometimes has cinnamon in it or different spices, maybe chili. But we also went to Mexico City and tried the chocolate of this man, Hector, who runs a place called Casa Tropical. And he uses that chocolate from Chiapas, but makes a more refined version of it. He really has this passion for creating a new type of Mexican chocolate that is neither European nor the granular chocolate that's familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to create something that tastes of Mexico. And he had this beautiful thing where he was talking about how people eat his chocolate and they feel something. And he says they feel it because chocolate has been in Mexican culture since the Mayans. It was used as money in the past. So it's something that's deeply embedded in the people and the history of Mexico. And that, he says, has power. And that you can feel in your blood as a Mexican that it's part of who you are.
I'd never argue with that. Mira, Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Together, Mira Fine and Daniel Klein are the perennialplate.com. Now, be sure to take a look at some of their videos. You can find them at splendidtable.org and cash in on some chocolate with our recipe for little French fudge cakes. That's at splendidtable.org, too. You know, you've got to love hot sauce names. Bailey's Irish Scream, Psycho Soy, Devil's Tingle. Hot sauce cults are commonplace, and the selection is never static. First, because the chili plant is so promiscuous. It will cross-pollinate at the drop of a hat. And second, because chili obsessives, well, they're inventive creatures. Food writer David Rosengarten tracks the latest in food for Forbes and the Huffington Post, and he's been dipping into hot sauces of late. David, good to have you back.
Lynn, it's even greater to be back.
Okay, chili sauces. I mean, yes. Are there 1,000 out there, and is there really something new?
Yeah. You know the way that Mark Miller, the famous Southwest chef, always felt about this? He felt chilies are like grape varieties. You know, everyone has its own character, and that's part of the game in the cult of hot sauce, definitely. But in addition to that, there's also how you make the hot sauce. And it is such a confusing subject. There's no simple way to get a grip on it. I think wine is less confusing. There's salting the chilies or brining the chilies. There's cooking them or keeping them raw when you make the hot sauce. When do you mash them? How do you mash them? What happens next to the mash? How long is it kept? When do you strain it? Do you add anything to it? Sugar, vinegar, spices? I mean, all these things have led to a world of manifold chilies and hot sauces.
So what's new out there at this point?
Well, I would say the most important thing going on right now is people are becoming aware that, as we said, the varieties, you know, the Cabernets and the Chardonnays of the chili world really do make a difference in the kind of hot sauce that you have. And some people have been really using varietal chilies for a long time. I guess the world's most successful hot sauce is Tabasco. And it was begun in Louisiana around the time of the Civil War. But they decided to use one type of chili only that they were growing on Avery Island. And that chili was called Tabasco.
And that's the name of the sauce.
And that's the name of the sauce. No one ever thinks of it as a varietal expression. And actually, it's not exactly any longer because some other chilies are in the mix now. But it's funny that our first one in the U.S. that was so important actually was a varietal hot sauce. But then other kinds of things came along. The whole Mexican world of hot sauce, which started to get popular in the U.S. And these are usually not particularly hot and not as much vinegar as Tabasco. Tabasco has a lot of vinegar.
Right.
And the whole Latino world of hot sauce came along. Asian hot sauce came along. Sriracha sauce that started in Thailand and is now super popular across the U.S. It's a different kind of hot sauce. Also, we went through a period, probably, I don't know, 70s, 80s, 90s, still going on, when if you made hot sauce, you had to be really macho about it. First of all, the names were usually based on thermonuclear war or insanity. Dave's Insanity Sauce! I always said, if
and
I
that
ever
really
do a hot
exists. That really
it
exists.
Really exists!
Yes.
I always said, if I ever do a hot sauce, I'm going to call it Dave's Mildly Disturbed Sauce. I think it's better because I think if it's all about only heat, what's the point? Is it a macho game? Is it a bar game? Or is it something that really tastes good on your food?
That's the thing. And well, tell me about these new varietals. That's what I'm curious about.
Yeah. The one varietal that is towering above all others now as a single varietal for hot sauce is habanero. And habanero, I think, is working for a couple reasons. First of all, yes, its heat is fairly high. You know that the Tabasco chili on the Scoville unit scale.
It's the measurement of the heat of the chili, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the Tabasco is about 5,000 on the Scoville units. Habanero's about, have a seat, 250,000. But, you know, in the world of today's chilies, that's relatively low. There was a discovery a couple of years ago of a chili that is a million Scoville units from northern India. And then there was a discovery of a chili in Trinidad that's 2 million Scoville units. So 250 for habanero now starts to seem kind of low. But here's the thing about habanero. It has a wonderful, specific flavor. There, I could pick it out. I'm quite sure I could pick it out in a blind tasting. It smells fruity. It smells, in addition to fruity, a little bit like my image is always when I went to school and they would bring in boxes of cookies to go with milk. And they're not great cookies, not great baking, but they got this sort of confectionery smell about them. That's how I think a habanero smells. And it's wonderful with, I like it with dishes that have creamy elements. I make a Southwest Indian kind of creamy chicken kind of curry with some of this habanero in it, and it's just fantastic. But that's the big guy, habanero. You also see out there quite a bit of, it's not exactly a variety, but you see a lot of chipotle sauces. And
chipotle,
of course, is a smoked chili, usually a jalapeno. So in a sense, it's a varietal, but there's a lot of that that's very popular as well. I'm working with this guy in Virginia. His name is Bob Henry. And for me, he's the best. He's got 10 or 12 varietals in his field, and he's working hard to make sure that each of those varietals gets its own hot sauce. For example, he found a variety of habanero that is from Africa, and it's called the African Fatale. And it is the most expressive habanero that I've ever had. And it's hot, but, you know, it's a cool thing because the flavor of the habanero, like, sort of rides over the heat. It's just like, you know what I always say about Indian food, Lynn? It's my favorite spicy food in the world because there are so many flavors in that food that ride over the heat.
Right, right. Oh, David, thank you. Very interesting.
What a pleasure.
David Rosengarten is the man behind drosengarten.com. You can pick yourself up a single varietal sauce and give it a test run in this recipe for apricot glazed Tabasco wings. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Stick around for the restaurant as the stand-in for a happy home and what exactly is culinary diplomacy. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Different breed of restaurant cookbook is evolving. Usually the restaurant cookbook romances the chef and the food and the place, and that's lovely. But now the rose-colored glasses are coming off in several new books. For instance, John Gorham's book. John is the chef owner of one of Portland's most popular spots, Toro Bravo. It's Spanish-inspired, and he's co-authored the Toro Bravo cookbook. It's an unflinching memoir of family dysfunction and upheaval, and the restaurant community that saved him. Sally Swift met up with John.
John, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you write in the book that you moved 21 times before you graduated high school.
I did. It was crazy.
What was the story with that?
My dad was a manager for Kroger's, and he was just constantly asked to open, remodel, and move stores. And so for some reason, he just took it. And it was never a family question. It was never, did we want to move? It was, hey, we're leaving next week. And we got packed up and we leave again. I mean, there were times where it was three stores in a school year. And, you know, that's why so many schools accumulated.
And back up a little further and tell me about your mom.
Well, mom was very young when she had me. She got pregnant when she was 14. And her parents didn't want her to go through with it. And she actually did this program where she moved out of her parents' house and she worked as a maid for the doctor that delivered me. And the whole plan throughout that was that this family was going to adopt me. So she was going to give me up. And when she had me, of course, that mother instinct took over and she didn't sign the papers. And so it was a very almost friendship more than son-mother. We were very close in that friend way. But then there was a really dark side of my mom. She was very depressed. She had a lot of pain. She had a major car accident when I was three and broke her back and never got out of that pain and got addicted to pain pills at a very young age and just battled that until she died.
Boy, between that and moving all the time, that was a rough start for you.
Yeah, it was. You know, my mom kept it together until I was about 14, and it was... Looking back now, I see how it wasn't normal and her staying in bed for 3 days and going to rehabs here and there. But it never seemed to affect her on a day-to-day basis when she was on it. When I was about 15, she completely had a nervous breakdown and never came back to being who she was before.
You know, when you're a kid, you don't know that your life isn't normal, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just think that is life.
Did she function in ways? Did you have family meals? Did she cook? Did you guys sit down to dinner at night?
She was a horrible cook. And there was, we would eat together maybe once or twice a week. There was a lot of what she called fend for yourself nights, which meant you were going to cook for yourself. I learned to cook really young. So when it was fend for yourself nights, those were probably my better meals.
Well, how old were you?
Learning to cook was, you know, first grade, kindergarten, learning how to cook breakfast. And then, you know, cooking my own dinners was seven or eight and you know, going that route. There was, with the moving, you know, there's a lot of empty refrigerators because of moving, and there was, so there was eating out, and we lived in some really great regional spaces, you know, places in the United States. So there was some really great food brought into our lives with the eating out part.
But not important for your mom, it sounds like.
No, she loved food. She did. She loved food. She loved going out to eat. I mean, we were definitely, you know, middle class family that moved too much, so they were always in debt. And so, like, eating, you know, when we moved, we'd get a budget from Kroger's for the moving expenses. So then there was, like, eat out at great restaurants for a week, and then that ran out, and then it was go back to living, you know, on day to day.
You were flush for a brief moment.
Yes.
Tell me.
I think that was part of the addiction of moving for the family, was that we did get treated like royalty for that week. And I think that probably was a little bit of an addiction for them when they were asked to move.
John, do you think that restaurant work is a place where people go to recreate families?
Without a doubt. I think for me, that's what happened. The first, when I was 14, I said I wanted to be a chef, and I got into my first kitchens. I was, the draw wasn't the food. I'll say that right now. I loved food, but I wasn't that adventurous of an eater. I'd try everything. My palate wasn't developed yet. But I was so excited every day to be with those people. And I got them, and they got me. And it was a place of solace for me.
And always from the very beginning, I mean, what did it feel like for you to work in a restaurant?
Well, you know, when you're that young, there's a lot of hazing, you know, it's a lot of, like, you know, like goofball hazing to the young kids. And I loved that. And there was a lot of, like, hanging out with older, you know, we lived in a college town when I started, like, cooking at 15, 16, and I worked with all the college kids. And so it was like, and being in high school was a big shot. You know, if high school kids wanted beer, I knew the college kids. I could get us into the college parties. I could, you know, like, it was that almost being elevated from your age. And it could be dangerous for some kids, and some kids make it through it. And I, you know, I was one of the ones that made it through it, but it was fun. I was always enjoying myself.
There's an intensity there in that work.
Yeah. And my house was dark at that time. My mom was fully had her nervous breakdown. She was in hospitals. So going home was a very, very dark place. And those restaurants were the complete opposite.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you're a good boss?
I think I'm a great boss. I think I took everything. You know, I came from the kitchens of the screamers. You know, I got screamed at. I got, you know, by the higher ups. I remember I got punched in the face once by a chef, you know, because I teased him a sauce broke. And, you know, he punched me in the face and told me never treat him that way again. And, you know, I worked for people who messed with your checks and didn't pay your overtime, and just, you know, that all the things that would make you disgruntled in the kitchens. And you get in these families, and then you get those nicks, and then finally you get disgruntled and you leave. And I made an early call that I was going to be the opposite of everyone I hated to work for. And so we create a family, and it is a family. And once you're in, you're in. I'll go and pick, if someone got a DUI, I would get up in the middle of the night and get anybody out of jail that works for me. You know, if anyone has issues with their family, or I'll buy them a plane ticket and send them, you know, I want to take care of them as if we are a family.
John, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
John Gorham is co-author with Liz Crane of Toro Bravo, Stories, Recipes, No Bull. He talked with our managing producer, Sally Swift. Now, don't miss John's recipe for sautéed Brussels sprouts with bacon sherry cream. You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. The destiny of nations depends on how they nourish themselves. This is from the 18th century pundit, the highly literate and opinionated food lover, Dr. Brillat Savarin. And the idea is still alive and well today. Take Sam Chapel Sokol. Now, his main interest is the nexus of food and diplomacy and how they can be combined, in short, to change the world. He calls this tool culinary diplomacy, and he recently talked with Rebecca Shear in Washington, D.C.
Sam Chapel Sokol, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. It's good to be here.
What is culinary diplomacy?
So I've defined culinary diplomacy in a couple of pieces that I've written as the use of food and cuisine as an instrument to create cross-cultural understanding in the hopes of improving interactions and cooperation. That's kind of an academic way of saying it's using food to get along with people and to talk with people and to get to know them better.
But it's more than just being a good cook, right? There's a lot more involved.
More than being a good cook, it's being a good eater, a good host, a good guest. It's kind of using food as the kind of convener. So it's, you know, it's really what happens at that table with the people around. There's a really good word for this. It's commensality, which comes from the Latin com, which means with, and mensa, which means table. So it's sitting at the table with someone, and that's kind of what defines or underlies this field of culinary diplomacy.
So if you look at the current uses of culinary diplomacy going on around the world, what, for example, has been happening with, you mentioned in one of your papers, the government of Thailand?
Yeah, so the government of Thailand has been the most active and was the kind of the first government to really use food as a tool of diplomacy. It started about 10 years ago. Thai Kitchen to the World was a project to kind of advocate for Thai cuisine worldwide. So Thai chefs were sent worldwide to kind of propagate Thai restaurants. So in the past 10 years, they've been kind of sprouting up worldwide. I have friends who've seen them in Iceland and in Nigeria. It's like this is all planned by the government so that more and more people worldwide know what Thailand is and what Thai cuisine is.
And then we have the kimchi diplomacy of South Korea. Is that the same kind of thing?
It's a similar idea, yeah. So Korea has also spent money. The government of South Korea has spent money to kind of advertise Korean food worldwide. They started a kimchi institute in the south of the country. They've kind of been lobbying certain cooking institutions like the CIA to actually start a Korean food program along with the traditional French-Italian cuisines.
Well, here in the United States, we've definitely been practicing culinary diplomacy on an official level. In 2011, we got our first culinary ambassador, which was D.C. area chef Jose Andres. But I understand a lot has happened since then. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Jose was the first kind of nominated to be a culinary ambassador, and he was ambassador to the Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves. It was a kind of a research project to create a cook stove that could be used worldwide that wouldn't pollute the air. But since then, after Jose, the State Department launched their own Culinary Diplomacy Partnership Initiative, and that was launched in September 2012 to name about 80 chefs to an American Chef Corps. And the goal of that Chef Corps was to kind of advertise and promote American food abroad as a tool of American public diplomacy. So the way the program works is when one of these chefs is taking a trip abroad, there's kind of a target of opportunity approach. The embassy abroad will link up with the chef and will plan a program for the day. For example, Duff Goldman, the Charm City Cakes guy from Baltimore, went to Algeria and kind of hosted a pastry chef challenge in Algeria. Or D.C. and Chicago chef Art Smith went to both Israel and the West Bank in Palestine to kind of learn something about the food of that area as well as teach what he knows. So it's kind of a tool of outreach as well as learning for our own chefs. There have been about 15 trips taken in the first year of the program, which has been exponentially higher than anybody could have expected. And the program is amazing. It's completely unfunded. These chefs take the trips themselves, or the embassies abroad use speaker fees to bring chefs abroad. So the State Department's not spending a dime on this program, and it's doing exactly the things that the State Department should be doing, which is promoting, you know, it's an American public diplomacy tool.
But now culinary diplomacy doesn't just have to happen abroad.
Not at all. So there's also programs teaching Americans about foods abroad. One of my favorite concepts is the Conflict Kitchen, which is based in Pittsburgh and has also moved to Oakland. It's a takeout restaurant that only serves food from countries with which the United States is in conflict. So they focused on Afghanistan, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela. So along with your arepa or your cubide, the wrapper of that dish has kind of facts and information about the people, about the country, and about the conflict to teach Americans what's really going on in the world through food.
A classic example of culinary diplomacy here in the United States would be the state dinner. And you've written about the state dinner and what the key to a successful state dinner is in terms of practicing culinary diplomacy. Can you describe that?
As far as I understand, I've spoken with the executive chef at the White House, Christetta Comerford, and she she kind of gave me some insight about what she thinks about when she's planning a state dinner. And that's, you know, you want to represent American cuisine as the American chef should, while still making a nod or still making a suggestion of who you're hosting and the cuisine of the visiting head of state. So if we were hosting the Emperor of Japan, for instance, we might make an American mashed potato, but we would infuse it with something like wasabi. I know that's a very simplistic example, but it's the kind of thing that these chefs think about and they do a lot of research.
So now that we have a strong sense of what culinary diplomacy is, how would you respond to someone who says, you know, this is something just for the elite. This has nothing to do with everyday folk.
Well, we talked about the state dinner, and of course that's something for the elite. But we all kind of engage in culinary diplomacy every day, not even thinking about it. It's, you know, what's for dinner tonight? It's going to be Italian. It's going to be Thai. It's going to be Chinese. You know, there are historical reasons that there are all these populations in the United States were this quote-unquote melting pot. And many different populations have come and settled here, and that's how we learn about the rest of the world. It's, you know, my first experience with another country is probably through its restaurant. A great example of that is in the D.C. area, we have a very large Ethiopian population, and many D.C. residents might not know as much as they could about the country of Ethiopia, but I'm sure they've been to a restaurant because if they go on U Street, you know, there's so much good food there, and that's kind of the entree into learning more. And that's, you know, that's not happening at the elite level. That's going out to dinner on a Tuesday night.
Well, Sam Chappell-Sokol, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Sam Chappell-Sokol researches and blogs about food and conflict. Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection at WAMU in Washington, D.C. Now we're going to be back with your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me, tell me and I'll be around.
It's time to connect. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Check into Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. We've got Anne calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Anne, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
I was sort of thinking about all the foods that we seem to eat only certain times of the year, like turkey and pumpkin pie.
Right.
And then I started really thinking about black-eyed peas. So I'm wondering what advice you have about how we can jazz up black-eyed peas so that they can be, let's say, appreciated year-round.
Oh, gosh. First of all, they make great salads. Garlic, lemon, olive oil, ton of parsley, and mint. And let the garlic sit in the lemon juice for a bit of a while. Either get canned beans or cook them from scratch. But if you cook them from scratch, I do them in a slow cooker. And
That's one of my questions about slow cookers, because here in Minnesota, a slow cooker is one of our major appliances.
Yeah, it is. It is. And for good reason. Okay, beans in a slow cooker, any bean in a slow cooker, dried bean, A, do not soak. You do not need to. B, you can flavor the you-know-what out of them as they cook. So you take the beans, you wash them, obviously. You can take garlic, chopped onion, if you'd like, a few pieces of bacon. You don't need a lot. So, you know, for a pound of beans, you'd maybe have one or two strips of bacon or something smoky, if you wish. And by the way, that could be Spanish paprika, which is really fabulous, you know, the smoke kind. And then you can throw in any other vegetable you want if you want to go the stew route. I love to throw in some fresh or dried chili. And usually what happens is, unless the chili is searing hot, it's barely there. It's like a backdrop. And the only thing you do not want to add to dry beans when they're cooking is anything acidic. So lay off on the tomatoes, not any wine, and forget about the vinegar.
Okay.
That could flavor them later, but not while they're cooking. And then what you do is cover them with about 2 inches of water. And then what you do is you set it on high, and I set it for about 4.5 hours.
Okay.
And by the way, I salt my beans while they're cooking, which everybody says you should never do and whatever. I forget it. They have more flavor. And then I let them go, because then they go to warm. And if I've left the house to go out and do whatever and I'm not home.
Shovel snow.
Yeah, exactly. If I'm not home in 4.5 hours, it's fine because they'll sit there on warm and they may get a little bit more cooked. But any bean that you do this with. Now, black-eyed peas have that earthy quality.
Uh-huh.
And it's nice to sweeten them a bit. Like, for instance, cook them with shaved or just chunks of carrot and onion and garlic, but something or parsnip, because that's going to give them a balance with that earthy kind of quality that they have. Then that natural sweetness of a sweet root vegetable, it's really a beautiful thing.
That sounds terrific.
Yeah, and you could do them
sweet sour. I also wondered about cold dishes with black-eyed peas, where you cook the peas and then you mix them into something and turn them into a cold dish, like a side dish. And I'll tell you, I talked to my sister-in-law, and she mentioned this thing called cowboy garbage, which I thought was such a funny name, but it's like a salsa made in Oklahoma.
What is
that? You make the black-eyed peas and you add in, like you said, tomatoes, onions, all that other stuff, but you turn it into a salsa, which sounded pretty fun.
Wait a minute. That's cowboy caviar. That's another name for it.
Okay. Well, she calls it cowboy garbage.
Yeah, well, if you're marketing it, you call it cowboy caviar.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what's wonderful with black-eyed peas? Do you know the dipping sauce that you get in Vietnamese restaurants for spring rolls?
Yeah.
Well, that's fish sauce.
Okay.
And sugar,
fish.
Oh, yeah. This is Asian fish sauce, which smells like old socks. And you can find it in Asian groceries. You want fish sauce made in either Thailand or Vietnam. The three crabs label tends to be one a lot of people seem to like. But most of them are good. And as I said, don't be put off by the aroma. But that dipping sauce is about a tablespoon of fish sauce. This is for a small bowl. A tablespoon of water. And then sugar and either lime juice or rice vinegar to taste. You want it sweet sour. And if you want, a touch of chili. Now, you take your cooked black-eyed peas and you marinate them in that in the refrigerator with a bit of chopped onion and maybe some fresh grated ginger. And it's a whole other world.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And I put chopped coriander or mint on top of it when I serve something like that. It just feels like spring is going to finally make it, you know?
All right. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Hey, Anne, you're welcome. And stay warm.
Thank you.
Bye. Call us at 800-537-5252. And, of course, you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We've got Renee on the line from Austin, Texas. Renee, what's on your mind?
Well, my story is about 10 or 11 years ago, my younger daughter and I were touring the new flagship Whole Foods, and we came across this unbelievable aged balsamic vinegar. And it was very dear, so we waited a few weeks, and we came back, and we got some. The problem is the only thing we know what to do with it is put it on chicken breast.
Oh.
Yeah,
oh.
So we need some ideas for that. And the second thing was a few weeks ago, I was in Central Market, and they had black truffles.
You are not a cheap date, girl.
Well, we only got an ounce of them now. but I didn't really do anything interesting. I couldn't find good recipes.
Well, you know, the thing with a black truffle is you never cook it. Or you generally, I mean, you can, it's usually added to things after cooking, and as soon as the words are out of my mouth.
Yeah, we tried it with egg.
Right, and they can be. Is it very, very aromatic?
Yes. Oh, that's the main thing we did. We just went to the bowl and we smelled them. I kept them in rice.
Right. And now, of course, that rice is going to be fabulous.
And just smell them a lot until we were ready to make them.
Well, first of all, folding them into hot rice, like if you make a risotto.
Yeah.
Fold the truffles into the risotto toward the end of cooking with the Parmesan cheese. Make very simple risotto. Make a risotto with a really good broth and, you know, onion and, if you want, a bit of mushroom. But don't, you know, don't go crazy with the seasonings. And the good
broth.
That
might have been the problem. I actually made the rice after they had been, you know.
Right.
I held them in rice. And I think I probably over, you know, seasoned, and then we kind of lost the flavor.
It's a delicate flavor.
Yes,
but the idea would be that you'd make a risotto that would taste delicious on its own, because the last thing you usually do with a basic risotto, a classic risotto, is that you fold in a small amount of butter and grated Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese, and then you let that just sit for a few moments.
Okay.
And it kind of, everything comes together, absorbs, is happy. Well, that's the point where you'd fold in a little bit of sliced, or maybe a fair amount of sliced truffles. Now, another thing, as soon as I said to you, you don't cook them, what popped into my head was one of the
That was the other problem. Well, we did everything wrong.
Well, you know, nowhere are these, I mean, nobody tells you these things as you're growing up of, you know, now when you get a truffle.
Oh, yes. Yes. My mother didn't bring home very many truffles or any.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the thing you're expected to know about. But here's the thing. One way you do cook them is you slice it, you tuck it under the skin of a chicken, you put the chicken in the refrigerator overnight, and then you slow roast that chicken, basting it with olive oil or butter. And what happens is that the truffle perfumes the flesh. Now, the balsamic vinegar, this is also a seasoning. So what you do is you would use, just a few drops, but on pasta, on rice, in that risotto, over fruit, especially things like intensely flavored fruit, things like berries, strawberries, raspberries, that kind of thing. And on vanilla ice cream, it will make you weep.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's just, no, but it's really wonderful. It really is. And it blows people's minds. And then I put it as a finishing touch on, you know, simple dishes, the grilled salmon, green beans, sliced potato, that sort of thing. And that, and you don't need to, well, you've had it all this time. You know, you don't need a lot of it, but it goes a very long
exactly.
way.
Oh, exactly. We dole it out in quarter teaspoon amounts. So
yeah, and that's the way you should do it. It's over any kind of creamy dessert. It's wonderful. It's just fabulous. And by the way, that's not to say it isn't delicious, just a few drops on a fruit tart. So, go for it. Yeah. Enjoy the luxury, girl. Thanks,
I do. And by the way, it's once a year now. I don't do this all the time. It's once a year when I treat myself.
Hey, God willing, you can be able to treat yourself more often. Life
there
should be
go.
That
all
good.
All right. Thank you. I love
Take
your
care.
Show. Thank you for
Thank
taking
you.
My call.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. That's our luxury. You can call us on that number. And you can email us. You can go to splendidtable.org. Have you ever considered why pasta comes in so many different shapes? Well, one reason is that in every nook and cranny of Italy, there is a special shape because, God forbid, one valley should make their ravioli just like those people over the hill. The other reason is each pasta is designed to hold sauces in different ways. For instance, an Italian would never sauce angel hair with a chunky meat sauce, nor would they Alfredo a tortellino. Our contributor, David Leet, sat down with Maureen Fant. She's co-author of Sauces and Shapes, Pasta the Italian Way.
Maureen, it's nice to have you.
Thank you very much, David. It's lovely to be with you.
So I have to say, I think that most Americans have absolutely no idea that certain pastas were made for certain sauces. So what the hell do you Italians know that we don't?
Well, first of all, in the interest of disclosure, I am not Italian. I've only lived here for 35 years.
Well, that's close enough to being an Italian.
Yeah, that's. I think so, too. It's not that the pastas were designed for the sauces, because it's not that premeditated. It's just that certain pairings worked, and people liked them, and over the generations, they became embedded in the national psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things work and certain things don't work, and certain pairings are so known, so familiar, that nobody would do anything else.
Give me an example. Like, what does a long noodle do?
Well, with a long noodle, like spaghetti, spaghettini, linguine, you want something that coats the strand.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want the chunky sauces.
And then how about pastas with nooks and crannies?
Nooks and crannies, that's where you put the chunky things like broccoli or little bits of sausages. That works very well with the nooks and crannies.
Now, one of the things I read in your book, which I actually was fascinated by, is that tortellini only goes in broth.
Oh, yes. Tortellini only goes in broth, although the whole world is going to hell in a handbasket, and you will now find, even in Bologna, you will find tortellini served with sauce.
Well, I know, but when I came to New York in the 80s, I worked at a very high-end Italian restaurant, and it was tortellini with Alfredo sauce. Most popular dish.
You got two problems there. One is there's no such thing as Alfredo sauce, and the other is certainly not on tortellini.
All right, Maureen, so since there's a lot of confusion about all these sauces and pastas, tell us how to eat pasta, at least.
Well, first of all, pasta is eaten alone. It is not a side dish to the main attraction, nor does it itself have a side dish with it. You don't eat pasta and salad together. You eat pasta, and then you eat salad. It's a primo piatto, meaning it's a first course, which you can't translate as an appetizer, because pasta isn't an appetizer. It's often the main part of the meal.
Mm-hmm.
But it is served as a separate course. Pasta or rice or polenta, any of the major starches, is a first course, followed by everything else, and nothing with it.
And what do you serve it in or on?
To be perfectly proper, you serve it on a plate. But trattorias and families will use a soup bowl.
Okay.
A shallow
like
plate.
Like a coupe, yeah.
Nobody here talks about pasta bowls. Pasta bowls is something I've been seeing recently on the internet. Nobody here talks about pasta bowls. You have bowls because you have soup.
Right.
And sometimes you might put the pasta in it. But in proper restaurants, proper service, it's a plate. It's a flat plate.
And do you serve a soup spoon alongside pasta for twirling?
Never. You serve a soup spoon if your pasta is in soup.
Mm-hmm.
And pasta has many divisions, so you can divide pasta along many lines, and you have this family and that family. The one family is pasta asciutta and pasta in soup.
Mm-hmm.
Pasta asciutta is pasta that is not suspended in a liquid. It is served by itself with sauce or with some kind of a condimento. Whether it's sauce or not, that's another issue. But that is eaten with a fork. The twirling in a spoon is permitted in only one case. That case is when you have your angel hair, which everybody loves, in broth, which is where it's meant to be.
And not with the sauce.
Not with sauce. Angel hair is not meant to be with sauce. It's meant to be in broth. In that case, the only way you're going to get it into your mouth out of the broth is by twirling it with your fork into a spoon, but then you deliver the spoon to your mouth,
not the fork.
Because you have to deliver it with some broth.
Some broth, okay. And then you also have an interesting point in the book about cheese and how to cheese a sauce, if you will.
This isn't, it's not a national law, but if you put the cheese on the pasta before you put the sauce, it will stick better and blend better. And with certain types of condiments, with sauces, you don't use cheese, partly because there are certain combinations that Italians find inherently sort of unpleasant, and partly because it's just not traditional in certain areas. With fish, it's rare to have cheese. We have some lasagnas and a few things that have a little bit of cheese, but basically if you're having spaghetti with a fish sauce, you're not putting cheese on it. Pasta with garlic, with hot pepper, those tend not to, certainly they don't have parmigiano.
Okay.
And they tend not to have any cheese at all.
All right. So let's say that I'm a very harried cook and I just got home from work, put the pasta water on to boil. What sauces can I make in the time it takes for the water to boil and the pasta to cook?
The classic, you have nothing in the house, aglio olio, peperoncino, garlic, extra virgin olive oil, and red pepper. That's the classic.
Okay, what else?
Tuna.
Oh, canned tuna.
canned tuna, but canned Italian delicious tuna in olive oil.
Okay.
None of your packed in water jive.
And what goes in that sauce?
It's tomato. Good tomato. Onion, you can put some hot pepper.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's tuna and tomato and olive oil.
Interesting. Maureen, thanks for joining us. It was great talking to you.
Thank you very much, David. It was a pleasure.
Maureen Fant is co-author with Oretta Zanini Di Vita of Sauces and Shapes, Pasta the Italian Way. Now, if you want authentic dishes, let me tell you, this is the book to check out. David Leet is the publisher of Leet's Culinaria at lccooks.com. Well, that wraps it up for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought, an Italian proverb. One has to be an idiot to speak badly of macaroni. The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at our website, splendidtable.org, to get information on anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.